man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Wadiway, chilling in the virtual booth with my friends to talk about movies. So let me introduce you to those friends. First up, we have Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Well, Iffy, I feel a little weird about this, but I'm going to give my what's good this week to California Governor Gavin Newsom and New York's... whichever Cuomo it is, I can never keep track anymore. Have they made mistakes? No, the other one.
Andrew,
there we go. Have they made mistakes? Absolutely. But the one thing I will give these cats is that every time they go on TV and they have a press conference and they, you know, share information with their constituents and with everybody else who's watching, they are always driving home that you have to wear a fucking mask. And I'm getting so fed up with everybody who's coming up with all these bullshit excuses and all of these, like, you know, like, how have we made this political? I don't get it. It's making me crazy. So anybody who is using their platform to say, wear a fucking mask, I think that's what's good. So they're what's good. Wear a fucking mask.
Please.
In an exciting circle, you just made yourself a what's good for using said platform.
I am what's good. Yeah.
We are no longer asking. we're telling you. Drea Clark. Friend, sometimes foe, never a foe. That was
you don't just, want me as a foe, kid.
Treya, what's good?
Mine is not anywhere as altruistic as Alonzo's, but as you guys know, I do enjoy using my platform for anything related to Celine Sciamma, and it does tie back to Alonzo because. Couple months ago, there's no such thing as time. Some previous time to this
yesterday,
moment.
Yesterday, last year, I don't know.
Yes, I was contacted by the publisher of an ebook called Portraits of the Resistance, which is a book about specifically, about the work of Celine Sciamma, the director, and largely to do with Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which... we all love. You guys know how much I love. And they sent it to me because Alonzo said that I might like it. And he was right. It's available through Seventh Row, which is an independent publishing house. And it's great because it also looks at her previous work. There's something about Tomboy. There's a piece about inhabiting women's spaces in Water Lilies. So there's just great stuff about her approach as a lesbian, as a filmmaker, as an artist, as a woman, of the stories that she's made. And I found it very beautiful. It has tons of wonderful pictures, some of which, of course, being the two women from Portrait with their masks on. Oh, my God. See, I did an Iffy where I tried to, like, tie it back.
Yeah.
I didn't do it as well, though.
It was still very, very solid, and I appreciate it.
Thanks.
You know,
that's what's keeping you
solid,
off the foe list.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of solid, we have a solid guest. We have a friend, close friend.
Speaking
confidant.
Of solid, love that transition. Not a gas. Well. He's not a liquid.
Yeah, yeah. Just prepare. We're gonna get even greater than that.
I'm
we
ready.
Have writer
Let's
and comedian
go.
Dimi Adejuwibe. Dimi. What's
Hello.
Good?
Oh, so much is good. First of all, shout out to Celine Sciamma. I love Tomboy and Portrait and Girlhood, all of those movies so much. So when you said her name, I was like, oh, what? My favorite. What's good with me, though, about 2 months, again, lost track of time now, but about 2 months ago, I adopted a dog, and he is just the sweetest boy and just like a joy in my quarantine. So that's what's good for me. His name is Clooney. He's 6 years old, an old little chunker, very
Aww.
Snoozy and calm and just lying around here somewhere.
Clooney with an O-O or a U?
O-O, like George.
Okay. Gotcha. Like Rosemary?
Like the George.
Yeah, like Rosemary. That's who he's named after.
Oh, nice. I feel like pets make such a difference in quarantine.
Yeah, I just have this silly kid. They just make way more of a mess. No,
Iffy, what's good?
What's good with me? Sorry. You know, like we've been saying with the what's good, I'm just gonna go down my my Amazon orders.
I hope you start to get a commission if anybody buys these.
Because I told you all about that KitchenAid stand mixer that I got and with the ice cream attachment, and that's been I'm waiting on the ice cream attachment that I had to go to QVC.com. to buy because it was sold out everywhere. So as much smack as I talk about QVC, they got me. Well, guess what? Delivered yesterday has been my 75-inch 4K Ultra HD TV, Roku TV. And not only is it great and solid, I found out there's a secret way that you add a Pornhub channel to the TV. Now I'm unlimited entertainment. Unlimited entertainment. Good Lord. Also arriving December 17th, 2020 by 8 p.m. is Star Wars The Child Animatronic Edition, aka Baby Yoda, with over 25 sounds and motion combinations.
Say that right after you say your big porn screen.
Yeah. That's don't say the child after talking about porn.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's
animatronic.
Know, yeah, uh-oh. Animatronic. Okay, so today's show is going to be great. We're going to be talking about the Five Bloods. We're of course taking a call from the Who Shot line, and we have our staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment called Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the very important question: Is this important? And do I care? First up, Alonzo has a story for us.
Yes. Well, we had a loss this week. Director Joel Schumacher passed away at the age of 80. He was definitely one of the flashiest filmmakers in the world. And while his level of open gayness has been maybe exaggerated in a few quarters, definitely, certainly by the end of his career, he was very proudly out, as though it hadn't been there on the screen all along. He's probably best known to the kids, because all I've seen on Twitter this week is, oh yeah, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. But like, you know, he did a lot of other films. He did Falling Down and The Lost Boys and Phone Booth and St. Elmo's Fire and one of my personal favorites, Cousins. So is this important? Do you care?
Joel Schumacher was definitely important. And so, yeah, I care about his passing. I do love, and I'm glad you brought up, because I find his relationship as a queer filmmaker and with just that representation in general is so interesting. I didn't actually know he was gay myself until well after I'd been taking in his films. And there's a certain part of that you're like, well, yeah, but did you take in his films?
But then, like, did you see The Lost Boys?
Right. Like, but, you know, there's also, I don't want to subscribe things to people. And I also always want people to be gay. So it's really sort of a toss-up for me. But yeah, his work is fascinating. And it's been nice reading. Whereas I normally, anything that falls in the think piece category is something that I kind of cringe about, I've really liked the articles that I've seen about him, especially about what he was doing for just sort of queer representation in a way that that bled into camp, that bled into like desire, into visuals, into all sorts of things. But yeah, I think you mentioned Tigerland, which was one of my favorites.
Yes.
That had both nothing and everything to do with that same kind of viewpoint. And his range of films, when you look at them, it's bananas. Like, it's the kinds of films he made, and that you could, like, there's numerous times it's come up of like, oh, Joel Schumacher made Phone Booth? Or, you know, just the surprise of that. Yeah, and I think that that's such a credit as an artist.
Yeah, he made two John Grisham movies, for God's sake, you know.
What's Phone Booth, the John Grisham movie?
No, I'm just saying, in addition to all this other stuff, like, just he's that eclectic. Although, as one critic I know said, that in A Time to Kill, he shoots Matthew McConaughey like he was Ava Gardner.
I remember watching Phone Booth as a kid, like, just being like, totally like just watching it and being both like chilled and like feeling like, holy shit, what am I watching? This is insane. And I was like, they're gonna kill him, they're gonna kill him. And I was just like, I feel like it absolutely worked on me in a way that, like, if Joel Schumacher were to hear, it'd be like, good, I made a perfect film for this 10-year-old boy. And, like, like, looking back on it now, it's one of those movies I think about all the time, and I didn't ever attach it to Joel Schumacher, but then I look at his filmography, and it's like, he kind of did a little of everything, which is why I'm so, like, fascinated by him. I watched Phantom of the Opera for the first time the day that he died, which is an insane film, but there's a style to it that I'm like... Like, it's so perfect for that story. And I just am like, I just think he was a very bold director, and it sucks that he's gone.
Yeah, it's not like the source material for Phantom of the Opera was particularly chill.
No. The one thing I do want to say, like, he definitely got called out by, you know, Vito Russo, the legendary film critic who wrote The Celluloid Closet, kind of called out Schumacher for the fact that as a director who was certainly known to be gay in the industry, whether or not he'd mentioned to the general public or not, for him in 1991 to make a movie called Dying Young and to have it be about a straight guy with leukemia, it was sort of like, really? This now? Like, you know, so I think that there are, but if you want to talk about the gaze, G-A-Z-E, of him from behind the camera, whether it's Colin Farrell in Tigerland or Matthew McConaughey or, you know, Jason Patrick in The Lost Boys, like, that was definitely there. You know, you don't even have to go to the nipples on the bat suit. Like, one of my favorite Joel Schumacher contributions to cinema and one of his gayest is he did the costumes for The Last of Sheila. The murder mystery written by Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins.
As you know, my favorite part of The Last of Sheila are that most of the men are wearing tight white pants throughout it.
Not
so
by mistake.
Well done, Joel Schumacher.
Moving on, we do have 300 black artists called on Hollywood to divest from police and anti-black content. As reported in Variety, over 300 black artists and executives have signed an open letter to Hollywood to divest from the police and from producing and distributing anti-black content. Me and Demi agree, so make it 302. some of the signers include Chadwick Boseman.
Oh, I was part of the original 300. I don't know how you did it.
I don't know. Where was that email? Can I get on that email chain so I can bug? So it's Chadwick Boseman, Michael B. Jordan, Viola Davis, and Idris Elba. Those were some of the people on the list. The letter was penned by Insecure actor Kendrick Samson, Tessa Thompson, and Black Lives Matter co-founders Patrice Cullors and Malina Abdullah. And the letter reads, Hollywood has a privilege as a creative industry to imagine and create. We have significant influence over culture and politics. We have the ability to use our influence to imagine and create a better world. It also states the way that Hollywood and mainstream media have contributed to the criminalization of black people, the misrepresentation of the legal system, and the glorification of police corruption and violence has had dire consequences on black lives. It includes the perpetuation of transphobic stories, which are used to justify the murder of Tony McDade in Florida, Nina Pop in Missouri, Dominique Fels in Philadelphia, and Rhea Milton in Ohio. I don't know whether to talk before asking a question, so I'm going to just ask the question then talk later. Is this important? Do you care?
Oh, totes.
Yeah.
I mean, no question. Yes. I think the way that the cops have gotten a pass in this country, obviously there's a lot of different, you know, socioeconomic and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, power and wealth things you can point to, but the entertainment industry is absolutely colluded in that. I think it's great that we're asking these questions directly, and I love the fact that this letter, that they made it so intersectional and really called up the fact that black trans lives, you know, are a part of this overall picture and part of what we have to talk about.
Yeah, I wanted to say, this is why I was like, I don't know when to say this, but I saw Kendrick Samson, when I went to there's usually a weekly Wednesday protest for Jackie Lacey to go, who has let off many killer cops, and he was there holding it down, and he was saying, he was like, and he was calling the creatives and being like, you know, we have to change this. I do want to talk about... you know, police and media. You know, it really, like, I was just, I've been watching a lot of movies. I wouldn't say they're all particularly good, you know, but because but I saw, you know, I watched Spencer Confidential this weekend, and and like that was, you know, as much as Wahlberg loves licking that boot via movies, like it was the one movie where it just focused on cops are bad, but it always seems to always paint this like these cops are bad and not the system as a whole. And someone did make a good point, is like, as cool and entertaining and diverse as Brooklyn Nine-Nine is, it is another show that's like, these are the good guys, these are the ones we trust, and as much as right wingers yell at us online and want us to believe we're not important, everything we create still does have an effect on people. There's a reason that people think that are fighting so hard to believe that, no, that person must have done something wrong for a cop to do this, because they are so brainwashed into thinking cops good, people bad. I mean, it goes even deeper to where D&D has gotten rid of quote-unquote evil races, because the racist ideology that just being a certain race, you can be evil, finally, years later, they're like, oh yeah, that's not so good. But it's like little things like that, and kind of looking at morals as a black and white thing, not a case by case thing, is how you get into these positions, because you are taught to believe cops good, anyone against the cop bad, instead of looking at like what really went down.
I think this is such a— oh, go for it, Drea.
No, I was just gonna say, I cede my time to Iffy.
I feel like this is such a— it's like an important open letter and like a thing to call for, but I am just so like— there's a cynic in me that's just like, I don't know that this is going to go down the way we think, because it, like, just having Hollywood as a whole divest from like the police feels like something that at first will be like, oh yeah, it's easy. They just won't, I don't know, invest in police anymore. But then it's like, if you think about how deeply rooted even just the idea of like cops and even just like police involvement in a lot of Hollywood productions is, it feels like it's going to be harder. Like you said, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but then there— it's just like there are entire staples of the industry that are just devoted to depicting cops in a certain light, or even just like passively using like the military and like getting like tax deductions because like Michael Bay shoots a Transformers movie and they have like military extras or police extras, and they use police vehicles and all these things where it's like they're a passive force in so many productions. And like for Hollywood to go like, okay, we'll spend more money to not have these things, seems like something that at— like just to believe that they would do that seems hard to me, but also like I want that. I want so much to believe that they will go, okay, well, we have to find a better way to get these messages across.
On a small optimistic note, I'm reclaiming my time apparently in an area where we've already gone well over, but I will say I'm 100% with you on the pessimism of like, I'll believe it when I see it if there's actual change. But one of the things I hope this does immediately encourage is that, like, in the stupid pipeline of how they develop TV shows and what's getting the green light to go to pilot stage and what, you know, if they're looking at that and curbing, because there are a million ways that you could show so many of the ensembles. Brooklyn Nine-Nine could be about teachers. It could be about meter maids. It could be about postal workers. Like, there are so many stories that could be told that don't need to be set as with police as the protagonist and as the setting, leading to the sort of normalcy and the heroism that's just innately cooked into what they're doing. Like, there's just— So for me, in terms of who I will be harassing about things, it's promoting— I just really want a meter maid show, apparently.
The real heroes.
full of conflict.
I don't know what NBC's going to do with all their Chicago shows. They're going to be like, fuck. Like,
yeah,
what?
I was just thinking, like, okay, they're all firemen now.
Yeah. Dick Wolf is pissed.
Yeah, Dick Wolf is shaking right now. He's like, wait. Not my money's— not my— wait.
How many CSIs are still left?
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about the Five Bloods just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hi, Hi, I'm Renee Colbert.
I'm Alexis Preston.
And we're the hosts of the smash hit podcast, Can I Pet Your Dog? Now, Alexis.
Yes.
We got big news.
Uh-oh.
Since last we did a promo, our dogs have become famous.
World famous.
World, like...
stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Second big news.
Mm-hmm.
The reviews are in.
Mm-hmm.
Take yourself to Apple Podcasts. You know what you're going to hear? We're happy.
It's true.
We're a delight, a great distraction from the world.
I like that part a lot.
So if that's what you guys are looking for, mm-hmm. you got to check out our show. But what else can they expect?
We've got dog tech, dog news, celebrities with their dogs, all dog things.
All the dog things. So if that interests you, well, get yourself on over to Maximum Fun every Tuesday.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, If You Whitey Way. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Demi Adejuwebe.
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're talking about the Five Bloods. Demi, my friend, my confidant, star power user on Letterboxd.
Okay.
Do you mind providing us with a synopsis?
Absolutely. Well, The Five Bloods is a Spike Lee film about four Vietnam vets who return to Vietnam in order to find the remains of and make peace with their fallen leader, Storm and Norman, and also to find a hidden cache of gold that they buried when they were last there, all the while reckoning with the grief and sort of effects of imperialism that the Vietnam War might have left them with.
Yeah. That was pretty solid. And I think we could just kick into the discussion. I mean, we've seen so many war movies about Vietnam. And, you know, the question is, how is this one different? And I'm just going to kick it off with, it's different because it's the black perspective. I think this movie really tries to drive home the black perspective on the Vietnam War and what it was like being in Vietnam. And it's funny because someone did a post that was like Anne Frank, Martin Luther King, and Walter Walters would all be the same age right now, because you hear so many disjointed stories from history. It seems like they're all so far apart. And I felt the same way when I didn't even realize that Martin Luther King was assassinated during the Vietnam War, which did have so many black people, you know. And it's so funny. I think about, you know, the whole enlistment thing, and it wasn't, you know, until this movie that it really hit me that I was like, oh yeah, that was kind of screwing over black people, because who can afford to go to college? Like, this idea that if you're in college, you don't have to be drafted. So when you really take a step back and look at it, who can afford to go to college at that time in history? And that just really kind of locked me in. I watched this twice, because the first time I watched it in pieces. I almost watched it like an episode, and that almost did a disservice, because it allowed me to pick things apart and look into things without allowing the whole piece to kind of have its way with me. I'm sure everyone else here watched it in one sitting like a normal human being, but I also like had a deadline and I was like, oh, I'll just be able to watch this in parts. And then luckily I did that the week before we decided we were doing this. So when we were watching, I was like, perfect. That now I can sit down and watch this all the way through.
I almost watched it like that. I watched it like I watched 45 minutes, then had to do something else, and then came back and finished it that night. But I do feel like I wonder what it... like, would I have had a different experience watching it all at once? Though I don't feel like I would have, just because it didn't feel like I was sort of like disconnecting from it and going like, oh, this is not the story I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is one of those movies where, like, I think Spike Lee loves to kind of throw a lot at you, you know? And mm-hmm. so I think if you're taking it all in one sitting, there is more of that kind of barrage of ideas and images and, you know, speeches from the past and, you know, references to other films and all of that kind of stuff all kind of coming at you all together. And, you know, I always admire what he does. I don't know that it's always as successful as it is from film to film, but I think this is one of the ones where he really gets it right. Like, you know, I was thinking, just as a comparison to something like Chirac, from not that long ago, I think is as ambitious and as, you know, eclectic in the sort of tones that he's going for and the things that he throws at you. And that movie, it just kind of, it all feels a little too much and just a little too, I don't know, it doesn't all land as well. But here, I kind of feel like it all is hand in hand, the old footage of Muhammad Ali and you know, Bobby Seale and Angela Davis, and you know, these this friendship, and then this whole sort of like genre thing of it's a heist movie kind of, and it's sort of a thriller, and you know, it's a travelogue, and it's a memory piece, and all these other things. And I think pretty much everything works in service of everything else, and so you wind up with this movie where he is telling you all the things he wants to tell you about Vietnam, but he's also entertaining you with this crime story, and he's also like giving you this drama about characters and their backstories and all that meaning that goes with it. So this feels like of all the things that he wants to do within any given movie, he's doing almost all of them.
I had a really difficult time connecting with this film because of the same sort of kitchen sink elements you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also because it begins with this like 3-minute montage that gives some sort of historical context for, like if he was saying, the things that were overlapping at the time. It starts with this very famous quote of Muhammad Ali about like that it's not the Viet Cong who calls him the N-word. And that immediate, like I had shivers going into this. I was like, I love this. I want so much for this film. And for all of the films that weren't made in this ilk, like this shouldn't be the Black Vietnam film. Do you know what I mean? It is 2020. We are 50 years out from this war. There should be a plethora of Black Vietnam War films. Right. And so it's one of those things that I'm almost loath to critique in the same way that I would normally, which isn't to say I don't. That's hard. I don't want to put unfair expectations on any given film, but I'm also aware, like Spike Lee, like you said, he is a filmmaker who's bombastic. He makes messy films. They're often tonally wild. Like, And this one is no different than that. There was honestly a scene in this that's the most inadvertently funny thing I've ever seen in my life. And I felt, not ever in my life, you guys, I've seen some funny things, but I felt super guilty that I found this moment so ridiculous, or that there's like all of this, like a lot of the story is compelled by complete coincidental happenstance, or do you know what I mean? Or like it's this hugely expensive film that regularly just frames these four men standing in a row as if there's no other way to shoot four people in an interesting. So, and then anyway, it was difficult because part of me, my analytical brain, was doing all this. And then a lot of me was also so happy about the themes that were brought up, the idea of veterans with PTSD, the lingering Black trauma, and that there's this generational connection because Delroy Lindo, who's earns every accolade he has for this. Mm-hmm. His performance devastated me, but like that his son is there. And so it's hitting so many things that I think are important for audiences and important for like general context of how we see the world. But it was hard for me to connect to it. If that makes, that's a lot, but
I get it.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, while we're on it, yeah, the performance and the performances in this movie were great. I think, you know, Lindo really knocked it out the park. Just solid, just that kind of last monologue as he kind of works his way through the jungle. It really is like, I, you know, just talking about viewing experiences and Spike Lee as a director, I really like him, but I do have to get my brain ready to watch his like style, because because Spike Lee is one of those directors who's gonna like, you know, make a point and make it very clear, and by that I mean he will do a, you know, a description of a person in passing the characters will make, but then plaster a picture stop on it and give you that information, and like, and that will make it feel heavy-handed if you're watching it in pieces you're watching kind of the, because, and that's kind of where I noticed I went wrong, where if you're watching it in pieces and watching it a Spike Lee joint in pieces,
exactly.
What you're accidentally setting yourself up for is like something that seems like your traditional narrative, and then his like flair that just, and it'll feel so out of place when you're just taking it in chunks. But when you watch it, you get that that it's the flavor, because it seems so heavy-handed. I originally didn't get them. Like, why are they the same actors for the flashback? And then it finally hit me. And was like, oh, because they lived, they made it, so they're looking back on this. But the character that died is still stuck in as their image of them. And then it became way cooler to me.
I love that he footnotes himself. Like, if he makes a reference to something and he is afraid you're not going to know what that is, he will then show and tell you.
And then
also, like, for people like 25 years from now, if you're going to make a joke about the black guy who sat behind Trump at that speech, then you should explain what that joke means so that they'll know later. You know, that's like the kind of thing like Douglas Copeland or, you know, Thomas Pynchon would do in a novel, to be sort of like, I'll make this reference. And now, oh, by the way, here's the reference that I made so that you know.
So y'all don't
miss it. That's the kind of stuff that, like, bugged me so much in this movie, where it's just like, there are times where he feels he needs to pause and educate you on certain things, and it feels like it's context that I'm like, it's sort of stuff that I'm like, oh, this is important to know, but for the story, it doesn't feel like super important to know, or doesn't feel like it adds much color. Aside from the thing he talks about, the runner in the landmine scene, that was one where I was like, this feels natural and doesn't feel like he's stopping to go, like, here's what you need to know about, like, these people in history. And I really loved that. But then there are other moments in time where, like, they're just walking in Vietnam, and it doesn't feel like the information he's giving you is anything more than to just be like, people don't know about this. And I do feel like he feels the need to educate people with this movie, even just because, I wonder if that's just because he feels like he's delivering a movie about, like, a time period and people that aren't ever covered. So he's like, I want to, like, I don't want to leave any stone unturned. But at the same time, it feels so like, like, I was just like, okay, but is, like, when he stops and goes to, like, the PowerPoint mode, that's when I'm like, well, this just feels like it's distracting in a way that I don't care much for.
If we go back to the plot, I think that was my one kind of, even with my second watching takeaway, is that it could have just been simplified, and I think it would have flowed a little smoother than me. Like, I was truly expecting this kind of even beautifully told story of these vets going back to Vietnam for this gold that they left, and that kind of tearing them apart, kind of what is lightly implied in the hella telegraphed mind scene before it gets good, which is like this, we came here, and especially since there were a lot of breadcrumbs that would have led to that, which is, you know, Norman saying that we got to give this to the community. So that's the story I would have liked to see, is these vets coming in and then the son joining in and all these extra things coming in, and they're going back because they originally wanted to get his remains and get the gold for reparations. But as they get closer, they get greedier, and we see the backstabbing that was kind of built up and then completely thrown away when we got to the third act weird French guy and the Vietnamese people, who kind of did have a point that they were owed those pieces of gold.
It was initially intended for them too, which you kind of lose in the plot.
That's
where the Treasure Sierra Madre references come in, because definitely the closer they get to the money, the more sort of emotionally they unravel, you know.
Yeah,
sorry,
Speaking of that reference, there are certain, like, references he makes in this that just threw me off of the tone entirely, like that, and when he has, is it Isaiah Whitlock Jr.? Is that, who's the actor? When he has him do the Clay Davis sheet, I was like, why, who is this, like, do you want us to laugh? What is going on with these references? But then I also think that there is something that he, like, the whole thing of, like, the Vietnam, like, mercenaries also being owed the gold is such a good point that I wish he'd sort of, like, played out more, where it's, like, they were also victims of this war, and he's, like, sort of frames them as villains, where he could have just been, like, well, you're all villains of an unseen, like, and I know he has the French businessman, the Jean Reno guy, but it feels so underwritten how he portrays it, as like there are all of the villains, and then he turns it into Rambo at the end, where it should have just been like, we should feel bad for all of these people, as opposed to just like, yeah, fuck these guys, I hope they get killed by the Five Bloods.
Yeah, all in all, I think it's time we start getting down to it, giving our final thoughts and our views with the way that we review movies here, which is screen it, stream it, or skip it. Stream it being screen it being the highest, even though, you know, now you screen it. Well, I can screen it on my 75-inch TCL 4K HDR TV. It feels like I'm watching on a big screen. But,
You shit on QVC so much because you're trying to get that job? Or what? trying to be the new QVC?
We got 10 more minutes, everybody.
IFY.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, make sure you tune into
my
live.
Only four left in stock.
Yeah, yeah. Please, you gotta hurry right now.
Comes with a free animatronic, The Child.
So, yeah, Demi, what are your final thoughts, and what rating would you give it?
I gotta go stream it. I do think it's a very, it's a fascinating subject matter, and I think Spike Lee is one of the best people to tell it, but I also think that he's got a style that focuses, there's so many stories he wants to tell here, and he sort of doesn't fully nail any one of them, but then they're just like, the performance from Delroy Lindo alone, I think, carries this movie so much and does so much that I think a lesser filmmaker would have just been like, I gotta have you like follow my trail and like go to a definite point and like say something that feels like a definite statement about like Republicans or Black Republicans or just like a man who's been traumatized by war. And he just sort of like lets it go in a direction where you don't feel like you get any sort of closure to his story, but that seems like the point. And I think that is fascinating enough to watch that there are so many other things about this movie that I don't care for that one aspect of it allows me to just go, it's worth watching.
I'm also a stream it. I think, like I said, there was a lot of disconnect, but there was so much intent that I liked. And also, even if it seems like wild and messy, there was something to watch. Do you know what I mean? A lot of movies are not giving me enough to sink my teeth into. And so for that, yeah, I think it's a nice thing. If there was a way to drop the score entirely when you view it, but you might have to run it through an editing software, but I would recommend that if you could. And I also want to shout out Jonathan Majors, whom I think is amazing. He plays Delroy Lindo's son. He was in The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which I talked about last year. And I think he's an incredible talent. And you will know very quickly that he went to Morehouse. And so, yeah, enjoy that and enjoy him wearing the shirt.
I would say screen it. Like, I hope, frankly, that I get to see this projected someday on the big screen because, yeah, it is messy and imperfect, absolutely. But I feel like this is Spike Lee with his film studies professor hat on and his black studies professor hat on. And I'm here for both those classes. So I love his love of cinema and just both in terms of referencing things and in just sort of playing around with what the medium can do. And I love his sort of anger and his need to explain and his need to contextualize. And I it doesn't always work for me, but in this movie, I much more often than not, it was totally, I was down for it. So yeah, I would say screen it.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I'm like right in between screen it and stream it for me. Like I said, like upon my second viewing, I was really able to appreciate this movie. And I will say the difference between my first viewing and second viewing, besides, you know, watching it in parts, is that is when my 75 inch did come in and I saw it. So I think this might be one of those films you want to see on the big screen to really kind of take it in, because I think there's a lot of beautiful shots. I really like the device of switching the aspect ratio when we go into flashbacks and the grain, pumping the grain up. Like a lot of that is fun, but yeah, but it is, you know, I will give you the trigger warning. I did not have, you will watch a man really literally get murdered at the beginning of the film. And I was
fucking
like, Spike,
crazy.
You did it again.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
the second Spike Lee film I've seen where I've watched a person get murdered.
And then he just throws in like single frames of like Vietnamese children like who've been brutalized. And I was like, what? You don't need this.
Yeah.
So yeah, be just if you're worried about those things, I just want to give you a heads up.
Well, the thing with the guy getting shot in the head was like a really iconic image of the, like that picture ran in Life magazine. There's an entire wall of a character in Woody Allen's Stardust Memories where that's what's on it. So
yeah,
like for me, that's just like a piece of history. But I
it's new to a lot of people.
Sure,
that
no,
and the
absolutely.
Children with the napalm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I've always seen that photo, seeing it in motion and then seeing blood spurt out of his head was a thing where I was like, no, thank you. I don't want that at all.
Yeah.
Y'all were not alive in the 70s and it shows. That's all I'm going to say.
All right, y'all. Well, you're going to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll be on the Who Shot line talking to y'all. So just stay around. It's going down. We'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
Hey, I'm Jared Hill, co-host of the brand new Maximum Fun podcast, Fan Time.
And I'm Travelle Anderson. I'm the other more fabulous co-host, and the reason you really should be tuning in.
I feel the nausea rising.
To be Fan Time is to be a big fan of something, but also have some challenging or anti feelings toward it.
Kind of like Kanye.
We're all fans of Kanye. He's a musical genius, but like, you know.
He thinks slavery is a choice.
Or like the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Like, I love the drama, but do I want to see black women fighting each other on screen?
Ew. To the nah.
We're tackling all of those complex and complicated conversations about the people, places, and things that we love.
Even though they may not love us back.
Fanti, Maximum Fun, podcast.
Ow.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Demi Dijuibe.
Drea Clark.
Now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. Casey, play that call.
Hey, Ify. Hey, Drea. Hey, Alonzo. Hey, Casey. First off, just want to say super big fan of the show. Okay, so my question is, I really love the Evil Dead trilogy, and much to my friend's dismay and my delight, I found out that there was actually a musical that was created in 2003 and is still touring, so they're going to have to deal with that. The Evil Dead franchise also has a modern remake and a 3-season-long TV show. By all accounts, this should not be true, but I'm very happy that all of this is true. So I want to ask you guys, what's the standalone movie that you think deserves an original trilogy, a remake, a 3-season TV show, and its own musical? All right. That's it. Bye.
Thank you for saying all our names. That made me feel so special.
Well, not all our names.
Ooh, my bad. Sorry, Demi.
How couldn't they guess I'd be here?
They just leave a blank space for the guest, and then it'd be like, Demi, you know. Yeah.
You missed your movie phone to do it.
Yeah.
I love this question. I already said my favorite Who Shot Line questions are ones that feel like they would be good dorm community rec room stoner conversations. And this one definitely falls in that.
Wait. But what if?
And you just talk for hours and hours. I also love this question because developing ideas is part of what I do as a producer. And the one that I came up with, I'm now so excited about that I'm like, could I do this? Except for there's one very crucial person that I would not want to benefit in any way. And so with that, I'll say the standalone film that I would like to see this whole like sequels and a musical and a remake and a TV series, American Psycho. I think this would be so good. Ooh. I think the original, and I want Bret Easton Ellis to not get a penny from it somehow.
Absolutely.
But I love that the original, if you haven't seen it, it's based on a book that he wrote. Mary Harron directed it. Guinevere Turner wrote it or co-wrote it.
Guinevere Turner and Mary Harron co-wrote it, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a big interview with them in the new Written by the way, because the film just turned 20.
Oh, very cool. Oh, my God, 20. So I think that there's so much narrative possibility. And I also think that the subtext of this film and story about the Reagan era and about how, you know, class and money and all of these things, that there's iterations of that moving forward that, like, obviously that stuff is still always conflict heavy in this country. Don't know if you guys knew that. I just think it's rich potential, and I would have Huey Lewis be the soundtrack for every single one of them.
Oh, of course.
The musical of it would be a Huey Lewis in the News jukebox musical fully. So I get the rights. Me saying this, copyright. Patent.
I believe there's also Phil Collins and Whitney Houston in there too, right?
Oh, that's true.
But yeah, you could totally do like an 80s jukebox musical that is also American Psycho the musical for sure.
Yeah.
It's weird, like, because my picks have all kind of half been done that way already. Like Showgirls has already spawned like an off-Broadway musical and a puppet show and one documentary that's out now called You Don't Know Me and another one called Goddess that's still in production. A sequel that Rita Riffle did, Showgirls 2, Pennies from Heaven. So, you know, I feel like we're a good chunk of the way there. Same with Valley of the Dolls, which has spawned at least one TV show and one miniseries and a weird sequel that Roger Ebert and Russ Meyer co-wrote. And, you know, I think Lipsinka did a stage show called Ballet of the Dolls. So, yeah, somebody beat me to those two. So I think I would probably go with My Dinner with Andre just because of the sheer lunacy of trying to adapt that into anything else, not to mention make it a musical.
Yeah, two-person musical. Interesting.
Yeah.
Like the last 5 years.
Right. Yeah. Just a series of duets.
What are you thinking, Demi? What's on your mind?
I got two because the hard one for me is just the musical. If it's going to be a musical, it's got to be something that has its own style already that feels like, oh, this is so bombastic and unique that it's transportable to a musical without just feeling like it's a cop procedural that now has music. And my two are Waterworld and Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Ooh, nice.
Ooh. Because those are great. First of all, Waterworld sucks that it was a failure because it's Mad Max on the water. And Mad Max should be a musical and it would have been my pick if it weren't for the fact that it's already like a franchise. But I would love to see a Waterworld TV show. I would love to see a series of Waterworld movies. I would love a reboot where they, like, Kevin Costner is just like, is it Costner? Not Klein? Yeah. Okay, I always confuse them in my head for a reason I don't understand. But like just having like him be like one of the older characters now and just like having a younger, like Mad Max Fury Road type guy. And then also it's so built for a musical. It's already a stage show at like Universal Studios or something and it fucking rules. I just want every version of Waterworld that I can get. And Fantastic Mr. Fox is also so stylish and so, like, they have music in it already. It's so easy to just be like, great, now we do other stories with all of these farmland characters and then also we can have musical numbers. We can have just like them going into this grocery store and getting stuck there for an episode or whatever. It's just like, I want a world that you can then go like, we can do anything in this world. And I think those are two very different ones where I think you could both get musicals out of them. Like Waterworld, I just see a rock opera already. But those are both ones where I'm like, the world is so expansive. It's crazy. We only got one of these.
All right. But thank you everyone who's called in. The number for the Who Shot Line is WSY-803-1664. Now it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie at all. And let's get ripping and rolling. Alonzo, why don't you start?
So, yeah, you know, one of the things that has been really kind of cool in these times, especially now at this difficult moment in history, has been that a lot of companies have really stepped up with making things available for free online for streaming to sort of like brighten up our days and give us something to do and think about while we're all stuck at home. And Focus Features, as part of their, I guess, ongoing Pride Month celebration, this coming Monday, June 29th, they're doing a free live stream of Dee Reese's wonderful movie Pariah. And there's going to be a Q&A afterwards with Adepero Uduye, Kim Wayans, and Asha Davis from the cast. Jacqueline Coley from Rotten Tomatoes will moderate it. If you've never seen Pariah, it's this just gorgeous, extraordinary coming-of-age movie about a young woman having to, coming into herself as a lesbian, but having to deal also with, you know, telling her family, particularly her very religious mother, in a really wonderful dramatic performance from Kim Wayans, who we mainly know as a comedy person. So it's a lovely film, and I feel like a lot of people haven't seen it. So if you haven't, Focus is streaming it on the Focus Features Facebook page Monday, June 29th, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. See the movie. Stick around for the Q&A. Jacqueline's great. And check out Pariah.
I'll go. I won't even wait for an introduction or a cool segue. So my staff pick is something that is so, to me, I'm like, ooh, I really feel like I'm going to brownie points for Alonzo. Like, I picked this and was like, and I feel that so much that I'm now kind of worried. Maybe he already did this, but we shall see. Which is, I just figured out this week that on Netflix has like 12 films from this Egyptian director named Youssef Shaheen. Did you do any of his work previously,
Alonzo? I don't think so, no.
So Yusef Shaheen, it blew my mind because we've talked about how like there's limited classical options on a lot of these. And he had a career, he made films for over 50 years. He's an Egyptian director. He was also controversial because he was incredibly liberal. And he was an out gay director for decades before that was... I mean, certainly in the Middle East, even sure. more of an uphill. He launched Omar Sharif's career. And anyway, so the films of his, I would recommend checking out Cairo Station from 1958. And he actually plays one of the main characters in that. And that's a thriller about this sort of unhinged newspaper vendor who becomes very fixated with this woman. And it turns very dark and obsessive. And then I would also recommend checking out Alexandria Y. Alexandria is a city. It's not a woman. But it's a there's an Egyptian man and a European man who fall in love during World War II. It's also the first film in this series of kind of autobiographical films that he made in that area, and that he made them for like a couple of decades. Like the last Alexandria film I think he made was in the 90s before he passed away. So I would check it out. He's just an incredible person and artist to be aware of, and that being able to easily access that on Netflix was kind of a nice little joy.
Ooh,
nice.
All right, Demi, do you have a pick?
Oh, yes. I immediately had my pick because I've watched like 100 movies in quarantine now. And throughout all of those, like I have been able to only think about one that I saw early in quarantine, which is one of my favorite movies, I think, now. And the only movie that anytime someone's like, oh, we should watch a movie, I'm like, let's watch What's Up, Doc? It's absolutely like just... the most charming, perfect, funny, incredible, like physically astounding screwball comedy I've ever seen. And it was immediately something that I was watching just going like, oh, holy shit. And like the car chase at the end is incredible. But like everything leading up to that is also so good. I was scream laughing through so much of it, which I'm a very hard, like it's hard to make me laugh when I'm watching something, and even if I do like it. So I was just, the fact that I was like scream laughing and like clapping through it all made it feel so special to me. And I just have been trying to find so many reasons to rewatch it, and like texting friends and be like, you haven't seen What's Up, Doc, right? We should watch it. I bought it. Let's watch it. But it's just like, God, it set me off on a trail of watching a bunch of Peter Bogdanovich movies this quarantine and just a bunch of Ryan O'Neill movies. And it's just like, it felt like I had discovered something that made me go like, okay, here's what I like. And like, I could finally pinpoint just like, here's what I'm into as a movie. It was just so good.
It's the perfect, it's my favorite Barbara Streisand moments.
It's so good.
I can watch that movie a million times and always just howl laughing from start to finish. Yeah. If you haven't seen Bogdanovich's adaptation of Noises Off.
Mm. Oh, that's on the list. I watched Paper Moon and then... we watched She's Funny That Way just to be like, what does a modern screwball look like? Which I have mixed feelings about, but I still enjoyed it. But like, just so many things that Bogdanovich has done, I was like, God, he's one of my favorites now.
What's Up, Doc is one of the few homage movies that's better than the thing it's homaging.
Like,
I would watch What's Up, Doc over Bringing Up Baby any day of the week.
I also watched Bringing Up Baby during quarantine. I was like, What's Up, Doc was better.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
Shout out to Polly Platt, his then wife and producer,
and Buck Henry.
Production designer, got no credit. His movies got worse when Polly and him split.
No question.
Oh.
So, you know, I've already, you know, gassed up this pick to the cast, the guests.
Wait, you can't pick your TV again.
No, I can't. I cannot pick my TV, but my TV is the reason I did pick this. Now, you know, obviously having a nice 75-inch 4K HDR screen, I obviously went through Netflix and I was going through movies that had the 4K, you know, HDR setting. And then I saw this curious Polish film sitting in on deck, and it was available in 4K HDR, and I was like, huh, what does 365 Dini mean? What's going on here? And it turns out to be a Polish film with a deep plot. It's about a mob boss who takes a woman hostage, kidnaps her, and she has 365 days to fall in love with him. I was watching this movie, and it was one of those things where you get in too deep to leave. You get in too deep, and then eventually I figured out what it was, and then I was able to go on long for the ride. I think a lot of things, because I read review, I was like, am I crazy or is this bad? And I went to look I went to look
up
reviews.
But it was 4K, so you watched it.
Well, because it looked beautiful. It was gorgeous. The sight I wanted, I was like, take me to Sicily, baby. You know, it looks gorgeous. And I went and I'm glad I figured it out before I looked it up. It's just like 50 Shades of Grey. It's just the Polish 50 Shades of Grey. As a matter of fact, the book that it is based off, the writer said she was making a Polish 50 Shades of Grey. So with that in mind, if you are into that movie, if you are in the Shot fam and you're like, I never would admit to Alonzo and Drea, but if he, I might tell him that I'd like the 50 Shades of Grey movie because he's too horny for his own good. You better buckle up, baby. Because seeing this movie in 4K, I had to close the blinds. Stop. It was getting too steamy in here. It was getting too steamy. All right, Demi, thank you so much for joining us. Anything you want to plug before you go? Yeah, of course.
Nope. Nah, nothing's happening.
Where can people find you?
Yeah. Oh, I'm at Electrolemon on Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, you know, and Alonzo and Drea, thank you for another great show. Anything that you might like to plug?
I have kicked off yet another podcast. I think maybe I talked about it last week. Sure. A film and a movie. We just dropped our third episode where Dan and I talked to Justin Chang from the LA Times about Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game and Magnolia.
Oh, great movies. Magnolia. Yeah. All right. Well, again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. Just a reminder, you can buy a Jumbotron on our show by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYourPodcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYou@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.